Welcome back, everyone, to your favorite new irreverent podcast all about creativity, art, and design. I'm your host, Paul Jasper, woodworker at night, scientist during the day. You see, I switched that up. And I'm joined by my two fabulous co-hosts, Eric Curtis, a full-time, very professional woodworker, and also budding content creator. Not even budding. You're far beyond budding. And Mary Tsai, who is a professional AI designer by day, woodworker by night. Whew, okay.
I didn't realize that I was still budding 4 years into this thing, and I'm still just finding my step, huh?
Look, if you don't want things written down, you're going to have to deal with the randomness of my goddamn intros. Okay, so hi, everyone. Okay, so welcome to today's episode. And I'd like to start by saying today's episode is on a very hot topic that we knew we were going to cover, because as you probably just heard in my intro, I stressed that Mary Tsai is an AI designer by day. So we will be covering the contentious, the misunderstood, the amazing topic of artificial intelligence, or AI. And we're going to handle it in two senses. The first sense is in a general sense. We'd like to ask, you know, what is AI? What are some of the fears and what's some of the promise that it holds for the future? But then we want to apply it directly to all of us, which is as artists, as craftspeople, how can we use it in our design process? And I'll get to some of the other questions, but we want to start broad and then narrow the focus towards how it applies to us. So that being said, we have our own guru, Mary Tsai. She loves when I build her up. She loves when I put like additional pressure on her to sound like amazing. So I'm going to continue. So Mary is our own personal guru about AI. Mary eats, breathes, and sleeps design and AI for many years now. So we thought that she could start by telling us, and I think a lot of us have this question, in a general sense, what is AI?
Yeah, sure. So I'm going to give like really general, easy to understand descriptions and definitions. I hope that's okay. But there's a few different types of AI, and the term is thrown around really loosely these days. Like artificial intelligence itself is just, it's a subfield of computer science using machines to simulate human intelligence. And there's a lot of different types. So the one that most people are hearing about over the past year, 2 years is generative AI. So generative AI uses machines to create/generate new things. So new things meaning like images, videos, writing. This is generally coming from text prompts. And then traditional AI uses machines to analyze and find patterns in data. So things like, for example, like finding like fraud or spam or, you know, social media algorithms, etc. And traditional AI utilizes machine learning. So machine learning is a subset of AI where machines learn from experience without explicit programming. It uses algorithms that can learn any kind of task. So when people are saying like AI is like a hot topic, yes, it is. I will say generative tech is a hot topic. However, AI has been in all of your software, all of your technology for the past decade, easily. People were just not aware of it. And this is really becoming the first time where people have to actually realize what data means. Like in the past, I feel like we've always accepted it as just a way of using tech. Like, oh yeah, my data will be collected for ads, et cetera. But I don't think people will understand that literally anything they release online becomes integrated into these data sets that become part of the internet. So, yeah.
So Mary, the point that you raised that I wanted to pick up on, that, and it, by the way, great definition, was we've been using AI for many years already. Mm-hmm. So spoiler alert for those listeners who's like, I don't trust AI and I don't like this newfangled technology. I don't know why I'm a Southerner who's 80 years old all of a sudden.
That's just your alternative lifestyle, buddy.
That's who I wish I really was. For those people who have that, guess what? Spoiler alert, you're already using it. Digital assistants like Google and Alexa and Siri, they all use AI. Social media algorithms curating your feed, AI. Smart homes, your Nest thermostats, AI. GPS mapping software, AI, smart cars, banking, media streaming, Netflix suggesting shows, video games, facial recognition to unlock your iPhone. All of these are examples of AI already commonplace in today's society. And I think it warrants, you know, setting that precedent that this is not exactly new. Some of the generative stuff is certainly new, as Mary said. But anyway, that was a great point that it's already been in our world for a long time. So I'm not sure if all the fear is warranted.
But Paul, don't you think, and I'm going to go off on my first tangent on this episode, one of many, I'm sure. But don't you think like there's this tipping point that may be happening right now, or maybe it's just, you know, mass hysteria, you know, dogs and cats living together. Who knows what's happening? But I wonder if this thing of AI being cute at first because it was limited, and now it's becoming so ubiquitous that we're realizing its potential. And I'm like, the thing that's running a parallel in my head, and this may be an incomplete parallel, but when you have a kid, it's adorable, it's cute, and you know it's going to grow up to be a full human at some point. Right. And then that thing, like the first time your kid beat you in a foot race, and you're like, holy shit, like this kid is like turning into a real human. And then one day they just like, you have to accept that they are their own thing, and you no longer have the ability to restrict them, and it becomes scary, and it's a difficult transition for parents to make. I wonder if we as a society are now coming to this point where AI is so ubiquitous and potentially powerful, where we are just realizing like we never asked should, we just asked can.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, part of it is also who's able to use it. So before, when I was designing things for AI, the whole point was it's supposed to be integrated into your software. It's supposed to be invisible, et cetera. However, now it's like these tools that anyone could use, and it's not so much specialized. So one of the large part, like, I don't know if advantage is the right word, but one of the benefits of artificial intelligence and generative tech is that it makes things accessible for people to use. And that's why people are starting to freak out a little bit more, because anyone has access to it. Anyone can make these things. Before, it was like a bit more specialized within your field, or it was more hidden, or you didn't have, you know, the specific education to utilize it. So now it's very much just depending on who has access to it.
But hasn't that been the case with every technological advancement throughout history? Like, if we just limit it to woodworkers for a moment, for example, there was this notion when the hollow mortiser came out that they were like, this is the death of craftsmanship. Because now you don't need to be able to chop a mortise at 90 degrees or a particular angle. You don't need to take the time to learn how to sharpen a chisel. You just need to press a button, and this machine is going to hollow out this piece for you. So it is a lesser example, but it was the same argument of like, well, this isn't craftsmanship. This is just machining.
Well, Eric, that same argument came out when computer music came along.
Right.
All the musicians are going to be out of a job. It's when photography came along. All the artists and painters are going to be out of a job. And I think, you know, we've seen this time and time again that it does actually upset certain fields, but others are largely, you know, still intact. So I think there's truth on both sides that this can upset certain subfields, and it probably doesn't displace others. So as a way to probe what the fears are surrounding AI in a general sense, I asked an AI engine, what are the top 5 reasons why people fear you?
Classic newscaster right there. You'd never believe that ChatGPT wrote that intro.
So I asked ChatGPT, what are the top 5 reasons people fear artificial intelligence? And the answers were, number one, job displacements.
Sure.
One of the primary concerns is that AI and automation could lead to widespread job loss across various industries. I get that. Yeah, I understand that. And I think it will displace certain jobs in certain industries. Number two, Mary touched on this, privacy and surveillance. Privacy of your data and surveilling, constantly collecting everything you do as a means of training these algorithms. Number three, ethical dilemmas. So who bears the responsibility when AI systems make decisions, how to ensure there's not bias fed into the algorithms, copyright in terms of art. It goes on. And finally, the most concerning, I think, the doomsday scenario is loss of control, that the machines would actually become smarter than humans, will lose control, and they'll lead to an existential risk. Those were the, I collapsed two of them into one. So it's the top four. So forgive me, because they were, two of them were kind of similar. But those are the top four: job displacements, privacy and surveillance, ethical dilemmas, and loss of control leading to existential risk, according to ChatGPT.
Mary, response, because, you know, I'm going to sit back on that one. I have my thoughts, but they are not educated in the field of AI.
I mean, yeah, I think that makes sense. The what was the first one you said, Paul?
Job displacement.
Job displacement. Yeah, I mean, I think that we've already seen it, to be honest. Job displacement for sure. One of the top questions I often get asked is AI going to take over my job? I ask that myself sometimes. Like, am I literally designing my own death?
Okay, can I jump in on this point real quick? Because this is something maybe...
Eric, I thought you were going to let Mary answer.
I know, and I was, but this is something that frustrates me.
Go ahead.
And I don't know if I'm going to upset people with this, and I don't mean to, but what really frustrates me about the conversation about job displacement around AI is we have been displacing jobs with new technologies for 200 years, 250 years since the Industrial Revolution. And nobody gives a flying fuck because they're all blue collar jobs. And now the moment we have a technological advancement that might displace white collar jobs, everybody is in a fucking tiff about it.
Ooh.
And it is upper white, middle class people who are just like, this is a thing we should take really seriously now.
Oof.
Am I wrong? Tell me that's, wrong.
That 10% beer you're drinking is hitting
it's
right
hitting
now.
Hard. It's hitting yeah. hard right now. I don't mean to be an asshole about it, because it is a thing that we should consider and we should approach thoughtfully. But it is not without, it bears mentioning that there is this very clear, like, nobody gave a shit when it was displacing people who were enslaved, people who were blue collar, people who were lower class. And now all of a sudden, now we're upset about job displacement.
That's a really interesting point. I can't really speak to it, but that's a really interesting idea.
Yeah. Hasn't there been a uptick though in trade school enrollments? Do you think that's related or no?
I think that's been going on longer than the conversation around AI, but I can't imagine that one would drive the other. I think we're getting to a point where it's like, if everything we do is going to be displaced by AI and or technology, then why not, you know, do something that's more meaningful rather than try to make the best economical choice for it to only get displaced 20 years from now. But that's just a guess.
So the privacy and surveillance fears, I think we understand that, you know, our data and whatnot. And the ethical dilemmas, I think I get that too.
The privacy one though, I get that actually worries me, not in terms of like what people will do with it. It's just a lot of people are not aware of how much they put out there. It's just now on the internet. I worry about the youths that like just putting stuff on, you know, TikTok or Instagram, and like it's so mindless because you think, oh, it's just like a video or an Instagram story that's gonna go away. And like all of this stuff is data that can be collected by companies, whether it's private or public. But I just worry that I hope that people are more cautious on what they actually release into the world. And that's not really put into younger people's minds right now in education. Like they just think that it's just part of, you know, their everyday life. Oh yeah, let me record this. Let me like post it on something. It's not, I just hope that they're ingraining that into, you know, younger.
Well, Mary, all I can tell you is I tell my daughter this.
I know.
She's a teenager and she doesn't give a shit.
I know. That's so the thing. That's like, what worries me.
So I'm telling her while she's snapping, you know, her friends and taking videos, like, oh, what's that, dad? You know, they don't care.
I know. I mean, that's just kind of like the, oh, you're so old. Like, don't worry about it. But yeah.
In fairness, I'm 36 and I don't give a shit either. Like, there's only so much I can worry about, you know, and it may not be the wisest decision, but I'm making the best choice in the moment I can. And I don't have enough information or education around data privacy and security to make a different choice.
All right. So I promised myself and us that we would limit the general conversation to 15 minutes. We just hit the 15-minute mark.
I didn't even get to talk about the new of creating new things in AI.
Sorry. Sorry, baby. Okay. Sorry, baby. But I do want to say, I do want to ask Mary one last question before we leave this topic, which is about the loss of control leading to an existential risk. What do you think about that?
I don't know. I do not at all know enough about this topic. Like, I don't think that's likely. I really don't think it's likely, but okay. I can't say. It's very difficult. I don't think that we're going to become in a situation like, I don't know, where some of the movies.
2001 A Space Odyssey, where Hal takes over the ship.
Sure.
You go to that and not Terminator?
Come I was going to say Terminator, yeah.
Are you calling me old?
No.
God. I hate you both. Okay, moving on. Moving on. Okay, so now let's focus the conversation now to art and design and woodworking and all the things we love to talk about. So how can we use, or can we use it, or how can we use AI in our design process? Ready, go.
Mary, you want to take this one first, or you want me to jump on it?
You do it.
All right. So this is actually a great segue for me to circle back to the new conversation, because generative AI, in the definition that one of you gave, I don't remember who, said to create new things. And it is clearly not creating new things. It is taking in data and inputs and generating an amalgamation, right? It's smashing them together in some kind of neutron collider and putting out information. I know. I went science on you, buddy. I saw
neutron
that.
Collider.
Neutron collider. That's a thing that exists in the sciencesms, right? using it in our creative process in order, like if you're using it as an end, I don't think you're going to get the results that you want. Or I should speak from the first person. I'm not going to get the results that I want. But I do think that it has the capacity to be a new creative tool to spark iterations. And I don't know how to do that yet because I don't have enough experience with it. But I think the folks who are throwing it out, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, as it were, are losing out on a potentially interesting seed of an idea.
All right. So let me expound on that, Eric, because I did try it as a creative tool to give me inspiration when it first came out. So one of the generative engines is called Midjourney. Mm. And it creates really beautiful images with just a text prompt. So I was like, wow, this is incredible. I'd just like to understand more of it. So I bought a subscription to Midjourney and I started putting in, as you know, like occasionally I make sushi boards because it's just kind of a fun little canvas to make, you know, a relatively quick turnaround project, about a month long. And I asked the generative art engine to make me or design or show me a sushi board that had these elements. And I said, you know, gold filigree, like architectural elements, you know, a place to rest your chopsticks, dark woods. And I told it all the keywords I wanted and I hit go. And I'll be damned. What it gave me back was so fucking beautiful. I was a bit disturbed, like how quickly the designs came back in 60 seconds and they were stunningly beautiful. Like I loved them and I saved them to my Google photo album, which probably is training some other AI engine. But anyway, I saved them to my Google because I think it would be fun to try making it. Like some of the design of it was not easily made because it doesn't think about the execution limitations. It just was responding to what I asked, and they were amazing. They were so beautiful, and I will try to make one as a future project, just as a sort of proof of principle. Go, Eric. What do you want?
So you sent us some of those images and they were beautiful. And in fact, so much so that I screenshotted a couple of those that you sent so I could save it for future reference. But I wonder, my question is, how many iterations did you go through? Because I'm wondering the data sets that it had. if you had gone through enough iterations, if it would just start spitting out the same shit over and over again, rather than creating new. So new in that you hadn't seen it before and it was interesting, but maybe not new in that, like, it has a limited vocabulary because of the information that it has, and it can only create so many iterations.
Yeah. If you keep giving it the same keywords, it will start to give you probably a similar range of possibilities. But then you throw in a new keyword or two, and suddenly that opens the doors to a little bit new design. Mary's nodding. See, Mary knows what's up.
She's giving us that look of like, you two fucking idiots talking about something you know not. Go on, Sensei. Tell us about fucking AI.
No, I mean, that is right. The more parameters you give it, the more it's able to create new versions, iterations. And it sounded like you were pretty specific, which is great because you could get to exactly what you wanted. Some people work differently. Some people give it only like a few specifications and then they give it more slowly and iterate then. I usually do it just up front. So just like a long string of words, requirements, and some examples to use as its source of origin too. So that is right. Like, I think that depending on the model, there are specific models that are better than the other ones. They will start to give you images that look similar. However, things like, honestly, Stable Diffusion, Midjourney, they're so extensive that I think you could go for a while until you start getting repeat images or almost repeat.
Eric, did you hear? She said I was right. Did you hear that?
Listen, Paul, as one of the top three smartest people I've ever known, I have no doubt. I have no qualms conceding that you're right in a lot of different ways. But also fuck off.
Oh my god. Becoming a contentious episode for reasons I didn't expect.
Mary's gonna be the referee of this show. Thank you, Mary. Thank you for saying that was right. It makes me feel so good. Okay. So how can we use it in our design process? Like, in terms of how, one way is to use one of the graphic engines to derive, like, say, I want to see a cabinet with black walnut that is rectilinear or curvilinear with beautiful filigree and gold accents, you know, and that can give you some spark. It may not be your final cabinet, but at least it could get you thinking in different ways about a different shape that you never imagined, or about a different element graphically than you did that never came to mind. So that's one way. What's another way?
Well, sorry, I was just going to tack on to your last point. Like, think of it kind of how folks use Pinterest, I guess, because Pinterest's algorithm is pretty good. When you are looking through and you see one, you tap on it and you scroll down, you want to see others that are similar. It's actually pretty similar to that, except a lot more specific and refined to what you're looking for. So
wow.
I think that has been really helpful for me. Another way that you can use it is like the text prompts. So this is more, you know, maybe on people who are creating content, like, you know, just iterating very quickly on the tedious things that you don't really want to do. So I'm not a content creator, but like, I imagine being able to, you know, generate a bunch of descriptions or even thumbnails, and being able to actually one thing a lot of people don't use AI for, and it is so good at, is analyzing data patterns. The whole point of AI is that you input as much data as possible, and it's able to tell you what the patterns are in that data. So being able to, you know, evaluate which of your videos has done really well, or
how do you do that, Mary? That sounds complicated.
Eric rolling his eyes. I mean, so there's different ways to do it. You can train the mod. There's specific models that you can train that you can input all of your YouTube content. It'll give you, you know, the ways that, you know, these things have in common, or like these patterns in common are, you know, are performing better, etc. So Eric is not believing this at all.
Should we be uploading all of our podcast episodes into this engine and ask what are our best and worst topics?
This is why I'm friends with you guys, because I love you both dearly and sincerely. You're both fucking nerds in the exact opposite way that I am, and the idea of analyzing data sets makes me want to commit harikari. Like, I have zero interest in any of this.
Can I tell you something, like a something I did.
Like with deeply Instagram. Personal?
Yeah, like this is in the early days of Instagram when you can actually download data directly from the Instagram servers.
Oh, Jesus.
I used to download people's accounts. You could download every post they ever posted through all of time, along with the comments, the likes, what it had in it, whether they used filters or not, you know, the number of saves, the number of shares. And I would do data analysis. I would download all this data on really big accounts. And then I would graph their posts over time. And then you'd see how many likes each post had as a function of time. And there would be like, you know, it would go up over time as they got more followers. But there were certain outliers that just spiked way above the norm. Like, you know, normally as the number of followers increase, the number of likes increase, right? But there were a few points that were just total extreme outliers. And I would collect those and I would try to understand what about those posts is getting traction. And I would use that to inform my own posting behavior.
Okay. Like this genuine question. Is that data analysis and science, or is that the creative process? Because I'm not saying that they're mutually exclusive.
Probably both. Yeah.
No, I'm not saying that they're mutually exclusive, because the way that you describe that is like the analytical mind of a professional scientist.
Mm.
Whereas for me, when I'm trying to find an inspiration for a piece, I am looking at other people's work until I find the thing that speaks to the language that I'm trying to whatever the vocabulary is that I'm trying to use. And then I take that and I try to figure out what's working and I try to impart that in the piece I'm making. So it's the same process, but there's maybe less data.
Yeah, maybe we come at it just from different angles, right? One's like a more analytical data-driven angle. The other's more artistic freewheeling angle. But it seems like a lot of the same creative process. Is there anything we didn't touch on with our design process? So Mary, you talked about some text that we could use. So, you started to go into content creator. So Eric, you know, maybe you could speak to this. Have you used AI at all in your content creator, like the thumbnails or the text or anything like that?
I've not, because right now, I'll tell you exactly why I have chosen not to do it right now, because it's the cool thing to do. Like, it's hot right now, everybody's doing it, and maybe it's the perpetual teenager in me that refuses to like hop on a trend and like try to buck things. There will come a point where I will find its use, but I haven't found its use for me, and I'm not willing to use it blindly just to use it. I will wait till the point where I figure out what it's doing well and how it can help what I'm attempting to do. So I've not used it just yet, but I do have a number of friends in the content game who have, you know, Keith being one of them. So I'm curious if you guys have any suggestions as to how it might be useful.
Keith, we'd love you. Mary, have you used it?
I, funnily enough, I use it a lot, not in my creative practice. I use it in my everyday life as almost a replacement for Google, which is kind of crazy to admit, but apparently this is the thing. Okay, I also read an article about how Gen Zers are now using TikTok as their Google search instead of actually Google, which is wild. But yeah, I've been using it in like my everyday work of just like
how.
So for example, if I'm trying to write like a Slack message or an email or someone, it takes me a while, and I'm the kind of person who agonizes over an email over and over again and like make sure that it sounds right. So instead I just like, you know, spit my thoughts into ChatGPT, form this into an email, make it like a few sentences long. And then if it sounds more casual or formal, et cetera, you can adjust it either way.
Really?
It's just so much easier for me to
do
that.
Are you serious? ChatGPT writes your emails for you?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It's so much faster for me, because then I'm not sitting there agonizing like over each sentence thinking about.
I need to know something right now. Have you ever sent me a ChatGPT generated text?
Don't lie
to me. Do not. I will see it in your eyeballs. Do not lie to me right now, Mary. Sigh.
Definitely not. No, definitely not texts. No, that is not. That is next level. That I would not.
Oof.
It's when I'm worried about coming off in a certain way or where I feel like I need to be a little bit more formal or professional. That's when I use it.
Eric, suddenly I doubt everything.
I doubt everything. Mary. Nothing is sacred anymore.
Everything she's ever said to us, I don't even know if it's true.
This is what Nietzsche was talking about right now. God is dead. Nothing is sacred.
I just find it so much more useful than Google search. Like, I can be so much more specific about what I'm looking for instead of having to scroll through, like, Google something, look for, like, specific links, etc. It's just so much faster.
Mary, I wish I had that. Like, I don't think I'm programmed that way because I'm older. No. But I sort of wish I had more of that in my daily workflow. That's cool.
Yeah, I just don't respond to those emails until I like wait 4 days and then I'm like, ah, fuck off.
Or you could be like Eric. So next topic. So how can we use AI to enable our sales? So I'll start by saying, you know, I took a pretty terrible picture of something that I wanted to stage more nicely, and I just didn't. My house is old fashioned and the piece was very modern, so I didn't know what to do. So I actually masked it and I asked one of my friends who's quite good, Mike Crotty. Hey, Mike.
Hey.
If Mike could, if he could like take that image and like put it in new environments, and he did, and the piece sold using, you know, one of those pictures. So it was very, in that sense, it enabled the sale through the staging of the piece. Are there other examples besides staging, how it can help enable sales?
I mean, that would be probably the place where I would begin to implement it first more than anything. I don't know if there's a different way to do that, but just taking the object and placing it in a new, you know, environment definitely helps. But that like I do that in an analog sense, right? I just jump into Photoshop and I start tinkering with it and I put it on a white background, do whatever, add shadows. So using AI in order to do that, you know, to put it on a back, I refuse to take gallery photos like on a seamless. And so using AI to then jump in and put it in a gallery setting on a seamless, and then I can submit that to galleries for applications, super helpful. That could then generate sales.
Yeah, I was going to say, I do the kind of opposite. So, like, if not opposite, but if I do take photograph on the seamless or I have older pieces on seamlesses, it's just so easy to remove that background and put it in lots of different contexts. Is like,
sorry, what's the seamless? What do you,
the rolled backdrop? So you don't see the like floor meet the wall.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Got it.
Yeah. But I mean, like, one thing I mentioned in the class I taught WorkbenchCon is like you can kind of cater to your different audiences. So if you want to sell, if you have a piece that you think would do really well in like a corporate environment, then, you know, sell it to them using an office, like a nice office photo. Or if you want someone who's like super rich and has like a very nice, I don't know, contemporary style, like mimic their home in the photo and see if it'll sell. Yeah, like the environment, like you guys know that environment is huge for me. So being able to be specific on who you're targeting your audience is and catering your image to them, that's huge.
I know VR is a thing that exists. I've seen that exist. I actually used it with the Emmy situation. There was a VR of an Emmy that I could like place it in the cap. It was dope. But I'm wondering, is there a reality, I imagine there is, in the near future, where like I can upload a photo of this object to a VR app and then a client could potentially place it in their home to see where it exists and help enable that sale?
Yeah, that already exists, I'm pretty sure.
I'm sure, of course. Well, you know, what can you do?
Yes, I'm sure. I don't know any specific programs, but one of the questions I was asked to me at WorkbenchCon was like, can you just generate like plans or a 3D model from like a photo, etc. It's like, yes, I'm pretty sure that is feasible. The tech is out there.
So Mary, that comes up to the sushi board. So like one of the things it did on the sushi board was like this really florally, squirrely, spirally filigree made of metal.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh my God, if it could give me a vector file after creating the image and convincing me, give me the vector file where I could put that on a CNC, or at least I could trace it and do it by hand. That would be like the next step.
Go to Vectorize. That's a, I think it's a website and it just vectorizes images for you. Or actually the Illustrator beta has it too, but
okay,
I can't tout too much Adobe here.
Don't want to get Mary in trouble. In the spirit of not getting Mary in trouble, I'd like to ask, Mary, what are some of the major ethical considerations to all of this amazing technology that we've been talking about?
Oh my God, this is like an entire can of worms.
Well, sorry, you only have about 2 or 3 minutes to summarize.
Lock it down, girl. Here we go.
Yeah, so it's kind of what you think. So there's a few different things, you know, like ownership, copyrighted information, and then all of these models, these generative tech models, they all have issues. They are trained. So the way that these models are created, they are trained on data, and specifically data sets. Each one is trained on different ones. None of them are going to reveal exactly what they're trained on, obviously, for competitive purposes, etc. There is, you know, of course there's going to be ethical issues there, because you don't know exactly what it's trained on. So do you feel comfortable using it yourself? Are you worried about, you know, any legal repercussions if you use it to generate information and data? I do not think that will be the case, like on an individual level. But yeah, it's exactly what you guys think about when you think of like ethics and AI. It's also changing so quickly right now, like copyright law. And, you know, I think the government is also trying to put limitations in place. Everything's changing so fast.
It's hard to generalize because it's a moving target.
Yeah.
And by the way, you say copyright law, that's only in the United States.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Yeah. And we have the internet, which is worldwide. So if an AI engine pops up in another country, does that protect or not? Yeah, I see the issues.
And like copyright of art in general is so difficult. Like we all, I don't know, I haven't delved too much into this, but if I recall correctly, it is just an issue if it is an exact replica of the art piece. So if something is slightly changed, like even think about, you know, when people post movies to YouTube, they like raise the pitch of the audio a little bit, or they like mirror it. That gets around all these copyright laws. So again, it's just really tricky, and I don't know. It's hard to define.
So it really comes down to like Vanilla Ice versus Queen.
Yep.
Right?
Is it? No, it's different because it don't do. Totally different.
All right. In the last few minutes we have now, that was a very, very brief treatment of the ethical considerations, obviously, right? But we're not an ethics panel on an AI, discussion, but we just want you to know that there are ethical considerations constantly being talked about with how these AI algorithms were trained in the first place. Where'd the data come from? Was the data copyright? Was it not? So that's going to be a continuing story. We just wanted to just throw it out there as something you should be aware of, and you're going to hear a lot about it as time goes on, I'm sure.
I tried to like look up where each of these data or what each of these models were trained on, and it's so difficult to find because they're very generic. They also, there's like a lot of data sets, like the Common Crawl data set that a lot of the models are trained on. But like we know that Midjourney and Stable Diffusion were trained on copyrighted images. Like they have been investigated and discovered that to be true. However, weirdly enough, like my maybe go-to engines might be Midjourney and Stable Diffusion because neither of them store images because they work on like a diffusion technique that essentially begins with like random noise and refines it based on the neural network's understanding of the parameters you give it. Sorry, this went very technical, but like
you lost me in neural network.
Their eyes are glazing over. But it's just really tricky. And you know, like Adobe tries to be really ethical with only training on their stock footage, etc. So I don't know. It's just
Mary, for what it's worth in all my reading, I do want to say Adobe has always been given like the gold star for their ethical treatment of their AI engines in all my reading. And that has nothing to do with me knowing you and knowing you work for Adobe. I've always noticed that. So kudos to you and your company.
That is their selling point. It's supposed to be, you know, like able to be used in corporate use, but who knows?
Great. Are there any other ways to use AI that we haven't touched on in the last like couple minutes? Is there any like left, you know, left field curveball things that we haven't considered that anyone could think of?
So the only ones that we haven't really mentioned, we've talked about like, you know, generative AI. We haven't really talked about, you know, machine learning AI that's in software. That is actually my forte. That is what I build into Premiere Pro and After Effects, and like utilizing machine learning and AI to enhance your actual workflow. So within my program, Premiere Pro and After Effects, it's like the editing software. For example, if you want to, like a concrete example is if you want to extend length of an audio clip, but it's already too short, but you really like it, use AI to generate a longer version of it, and it can make those clips or those cuts automatically. It's seamless. It's called Remix, by the way, in Premiere Pro.
Oh my God, really? It can do that?
Yeah, absolutely. All you do is just drag the track shorter or longer, and it automatically remixes it for you.
God, that's amazing.
So stuff like that is super, it's honestly so easy. Like it's been in Premiere Pro for a few years now, and this is before any of the generative stuff happened. But yeah, that's a whole nother subset that I could dive really deep into, but will not.
Holy shit. I didn't even know that was possible. I think a part of my experience, and probably the experience of a lot of our listeners, is they don't even know what's possible with AI. Because unless you're on the bleeding edge, hearing about this stuff all the day, immersed in it like you are, Mary, I didn't even know that was on the table.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just analyzing the patterns of a song and being able to intelligently recreate it so that it is extended.
Holy shit. All right. Well, that brings us to the 40-minute mark. That's what we decided we would try to cap our AI discussion off at. And we will switch gears now.
I just want to say that I'm very proud I left the dick jokes on the table when you said other ways to use AI, but that's fine. We can move on now.
All right. No dick jokes for Eric. Okay. So we come now to our first segment to mix it up, because we'd like to have segments that aren't so heady. So our first segment that is a brand new segment, very exciting. It's called Whatever the Fuck Paul Wants. That's the segment. And today, what Paul wants is to use AI to tell me what are the top 5 reasons that you should not name your child Eric.
Oh, Jesus. Okay. I'm in for the jugular right now. I feel attacked. Okay. All right. I just want to say, hold on. Did you spell it wrong or right? That's all I want to know.
I'm not answering. So I asked ChatGPT to give me a top. I used AI to give me a top 5 reasons why you should name your kid Eric. And here's what happened. Number one, confusion galore, Eric, with various spellings like E-R-I-C.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah. E-R-I-C-K, E-R-Y-K.
First of all, hold on. Shut the fuck up. Nobody spells it E-R-Y-K. And if you do, you can get the fuck out of my office, okay? E-R-I-C is wrong. E-R-I-C-K, you're just pranking people. There's one correct way to spell Eric. Because
by the way, it didn't even give your spelling. So,
yeah. Because AI is confused about itself.
So it says, your child may be forever correcting people on the spelling of their name.
All the time. That is one thing that happens. My favorite example was when somebody asked me my name, I said Eric Curtis. And they said, is that with a C or a K? And I said, with a K, thank you for asking. And then they spelled my name E-R-I-C-K-U-R-T-I-S. And I was like, fuck you, man. You're just fucking with me now.
Okay, number two, Eric. It's overused. Apparently, Eric's been a popular name for generations, so your child might find themselves in a sea of Erics, making it harder to stand out.
It's a great name.
That's just the case for most names. That's insane. Yeah. Mine is more common.
Number three, mispronunciation madness, despite its seemingly simple spelling.
What?
Wait. Despite its seemingly simple spelling, Eric is often mispronounced as Eric.
No, it is not. Not once in my life has anybody ever been like Eric Curtis. That's not a thing.
Or Ear Rick, leading to endless corrections.
I like Eric.
I mean, I get E-Rock from time to time, but that's not a mispronunciation.
Oh, God. Number four, historical baggage, Eric. While Eric may have some historical significance, it's also associated with less savory figures like Eric the Red or infamous Erics from popular culture, which might not be the best role models.
I like how they tried to frame that as though there are a lot of bad Erics, and they came up with one example, and they were like, among others.
Wait, am I supposed to know who Eric the Red is?
He's a Viking, right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He murdered a lot of people, but that's fine.
See, this is why you never trust an Eric. And number five, pop culture pitfalls, Eric, with fictional characters like Eric from Phantom of the Opera or Eric Killmonger from Black Panther. Your child might constantly be compared to these characters for better or worse.
Yeah, I constantly compare Eric to the Phantom of the Opera Eric for sure.
The only two villain Erics to ever exist. You know what they didn't name? Prince Eric. What are we doing here? This is horseshit.
Okay, but Prince Eric was also very weird in which he
I'm not saying that he was not a villain. I'm just saying he wasn't the villain of that story. He's definitely the villain of a different story.
Okay, 100%. Saw a naked girl and was like, she has no voice. Let me take it.
A naked girl who couldn't articulate what she wanted. And he was like, bet, hold my beer.
Yeah.
It was not great.
Although, to be fair, Paul, I feel like if you had asked ChatGPT the same thing about my name, it would have
been. I did.
Oh, you did?
Go on, buddy.
I'm sure there's a lot of.
But Eric, you got it. Because we love Mary, I asked ChatGPT the reasons you should name your daughter
you
Mary.
Son of a bitch. Pandering to the audience.
Because we need to take care of Mary. Number one, timeless elegance. Mary is a classic name that has stood the test of time, exuding elegance and grace no matter the era.
So we're just going to leave Mary Magdalene on the table right there, huh?
Oh, actually, that was actually listed. Yeah. I'm not kidding. Number four, reasons to name your daughter Mary. Role models galore with historical figures like Mary Magdalene. Mary Queen of Scots, who, by the way, was Mary Queen of Scots, who was like put to death at age 44, and modern icons like Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein. That's awesome.
True.
I will give you Mary Shelley. Yes. Mary Shelley.
Your daughter inherits a legacy and a strong and influential woman.
They opened with Mary Magdalene, though?
Yeah, I was going to say, that was an interesting one.
Okay.
But, you know, I did that because, you know, we got to be nice to Mary. But actually,
you guys want to know a fun story of how I got my name? I think Eric
sure.
Story. So I was born 3 months premature, by the way. And my parents are from Taiwan. They have pretty strong accents. So my name was supposed to be Marilyn, named after a family friend. And their accents were so strong that the nurses were just like, Mary?
My parents were like,
yeah, sure.
That's unbelievable.
That's funny every time.
Yeah. So, and they're like, yeah, I mean, I guess it's easier to say.
Well, sorry, Marilyn. So last but not least, before we move on from this segment, I did want to ask it real quick. What are the top 10 concise reasons that listening to podcasts is stupid?
Okay.
Concise. Yeah, I feel like you stressed that word.
Oh, yeah, because they were too long. I was like, I can't be bothered reading all this horse shit. So the top 10 reasons that you shouldn't bother listening to podcasts. Number one, boring content.
Preach, bro.
Yeah, that's definitely fair.
I got to be honest. There's very few I find compelling. Number two, low production quality.
Hold on. Do you guys hear the sweet, sweet bass in these voices right now?
I was going to say the first episode where we upgraded our mics.
The investment in this pot for your ears.
So I want to give a collective apology to the listening public because my two cohorts had bullshit mics until today.
Excuse me, sir. We had the ability to record sound. That was good enough for the beginning of the podcast.
Eric, don't even pretend for a moment that you sounded good. So listen, we all listened to our previous episodes. I know many of you have been like, oh, sound quality is just Okay. We heard you. And Mary and Eric got upgraded mics for this episode. So hopefully you hear the difference. Can you hear the difference, Mary? Sound check.
Sa, she, me.
I'm going to need to move on. What's number four?
Number three.
There were
repetitive topics. And you know what? Someone actually, I'm not going to call him out, but he's like, oh, you may have touched on that topic once before. And I was like, yeah, that's how learning happens. We're doing this for ourselves as much as we're doing it for all of you. Like, we're trying to learn about design by covering the things we love to talk about. And so, yeah, that means we cover a topic more than once. We might talk about related things about creativity. I think repetitive topics is wonderful because it encodes. That's why I listen to every episode like 3 or 4 times to like really encode. And actually, Eric, I hate to pad your ego, but a lot of the things you say, I didn't pick up in the moment, but upon re-listening to it the second and the third time, I'm like, oh, that's what he was getting at. And I hate to admit it, but those are really deep, like thoughtful points that I just completely fucking missed because I'm dense in the moment.
I mean, you're welcome, buddy. You know,
thank you. Number four, they can be time consuming. I think we limit ours to a reasonable amount of time.
Sure.
Number five, inaccurate information. Well, maybe, but I think we tried to be fairly accurate. At least I know that when I come with reports or studies, I definitely read them before the episode and I cite the source. And Mary, I know everything you've said today was accurate.
Maybe not. I'm lying this whole episode.
Apparently I'm giving Mary more credit than she deserves. Number six, excessive advertising. That's not the case. Screw off. Number seven, biased or opinionated content. Isn't that the point of a podcast?
Isn't that just content? Whenever you're recording live anything, like, you're going to give your opinion, which is biased.
Number eight, overly long episodes. Maybe. Ours isn't.
And that's where we cut off the top 10 ideas from AI. No?
Nine is a lack of substance. That's totally Eric.
Wow. You just said that you appreciated Eric's.
I'm just kidding.
The emotional roller coaster I'm going on this evening.
I'm just kidding. And number 10, it's a distraction from real life responsibilities because you're all listening to podcasts all day. You're not paying your bills. You're not feeding your families.
This is AI who has neither family nor bills saying, right. Get your shit together.
All right. Anyway, that's the top 10 concise reasons that listening to a podcast is stupid. Apparently ours doesn't qualify. All right. So with that, we're at the 52-minute. Not biased at all. So with that, at 52 minutes, I'd like to just briefly thank our patrons in this episode. So we have Travis Pond and Bill Burkle from WTB Woodworking, Austin Santiago, Eric Gorges, who I know from Craftsman Legacy. I think many of you seen his show.
Most gorgeous man I know.
Met him at Workbench Con.
He's a great guy. He eats and breathes and sleeps making. He's an inspiration. And then we have James at Dirty Meerkat Woodshop. So thank you, the five of you, for supporting our show. We appreciate every one of you. And I often send personal messages to you. If I haven't, don't take it personally. I just forgot.
Thanks,
all right. So that concludes our episode. Now we're going to move on to the after show. And, you know, if you're a patron, you can have our after show as well as the video feeds, which you get to stare at Eric and Mary looking all hot and cute. And so,
Which one, Mary?
Yeah, I was about to say that too. What's this? Which one's the hot? Which one's the cute?
No, both are hot and cute. They're not mutually exclusive.
No, those are diametrically opposed adjectives.
Oh, God, what did I get myself into? I'm not answering. So in the after show, we're going to answer another AI-generated list, but it's very apropos, which is, what are the top 10 things woodworkers are bad at?
That's a good one.
We're holding AI to the after show, huh?
So before we go to the after show, and I'll tell you what AI said that we're bad at. You guys have any guesses?
Joinery. Proportions, wood selection, grain selection. I got lots of guesses. What are we doing?
I mean, it's a very, very vague question. It could be everything, basically.
Mary, what are you bad at? Maybe it's on there.
Oh, are we talking about specifically ourselves?
Woodworkers. I don't know. You're a woodworker, right?
Yeah, that's true. I don't know.
Marketing, design inspiration. Your family.
Well, if you want the answer, you're going to have to tune in the after show and we will divulge all 10 and we'll take ourselves to task. In the meantime, thank you all. I hope you found today's episode illuminating. Thank you, Mary, again, for your insight. We knew and the minute we started this podcast, we knew we would cover AI because Mary is such a authority on the area. Mary, I know you worry about the pressure of being an authority, but you are. And so we really appreciate your perspective. And even if you didn't give an answer, you know, like definitively one way or the other, that is an answer, which is I don't know yet, or we don't know yet. We're going to have to see how it shakes out. So that kind of, you know, balanced perspective is definitely appreciated by all of us. And we hope that some of the ideas around how to use AI, both like ChatGPT or image generation or video production, you know, can be useful in your daily lives as you try to create things. I know for me, I definitely will try to make one of the sushi board designs that AI gave me at some point. And I'll definitely, we'll see how it goes. With that, friends, thank you for tuning in to another episode of Woodworking is Bullshit.
We'll see you later. Thanks, friendos.
Thank you.
Make good decisions.
Or bad. Bye.
Say hi to your moms for me.